They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally, they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back.
Baby, come back. Bye, 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 bye. Bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
Hello, D-Brothers. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Although,
let's hope something bad hasn't happened already. I mean, like, it literally must be like a week into 2021. And we'll already know. How quickly did we know 2020 was bad? It wasn't until like February, was it?
I think even then we weren't that. I was pretty confident we'd get through this.
Well, 2021's looking great so far. Brexit done, vaccine rollout. We should have had several million people vaccinated by now. So this is either going to be it's going to sound terribly out of date, or it's going to be incredibly up to date.
You're probably listening to this at a massive house party of 100,000, all snogging because you can for the first time. Just
mass orgies, government sponsored mass orgies.
Finally, the orgies are back. Finally, we need to get. There's always got to be one disease out of control.
Wasn't there a period where, right at the start of lockdowns, they literally kept finding footballers having orgies? And you were like, of all the things to start doing, like, it just, why go straight for the orgies? Oh my God, there's lockdown! Orgy!
Just don't think they ever stopped. It's just they finally had excess energy with all the games cancelled. They had to put it somewhere. The energy. But before we go into, we always like to introduce our guests. We have an apology for this week's guest. We switched our recording platform from Skype to BlueJeans, which is why we've changed the excuse for why the sound quality is bad from one reason to another reason.
But we'd like to give the impression that we've tried to do something about it.
But good news on that. We've used the money from the lovely sponsor Food Hub to buy kick-ass mics. So hopefully we will
There's
be getting
excuse in the mix for when it, yeah. when it's still bad.
It's when you realize how horrible our voices in the ear actually are without all the crackle and the distortion to drown us out. But Paul was our last interview on Skype, and we've only just realized that it was in my Dropbox and not in the new folder that we use for our interviews. So we interviewed Paul. Well, given that we speak to him mainly about the Wainwright's attempt, which is about a year and a half old. It could have been a year and a half ago, for all you know. But apologies, Paul, for taking so long, because, that's the reason. But interestingly enough, I was reading about him today, this morning. Have you heard about the good news?
There's multiple things that could be good news, but I'm thinking you're talking about in relation to running.
Yeah, they have found, and apologies, I haven't got that many details because it was behind a paywall for the Times, and you know, I'm not paying for the Times, maybe the Guardian or the Observer.
You're not paying for anything.
I'm not paying for anything, true.
I refuse to pay for journalism.
Why did you lose your job, JD? Anyway, turns out that Paul has been working with a doctor who also has got a bit of an analytical background, and they've run the Wainwright route through an algorithm that has now come up with a faster way of doing it. So,
a computer. This is. I like your description. He's got a doctor with a bit of an analytical background. I mean, well, that doesn't really explain much. But so I like this. I like the fact have they used AI to formulate a better route.
I don't think you even need AI for it. Actually, we had to come up with a similar program when we were at university. It might just be that they've got bigger computers now, super processors that can analyze bigger sets of data. But let's call it AI. Let's call it machine learning AI.
Call it AI. Everyone does.
Soon the Terminator 2 is going to be breaking the record for the Wainwrights with its superior knowledge. But yeah, interesting, because that's one of the things that we actually talked about, is how Sabrina had found a slightly different route for her attempt. And the thing is, the reality is, of whatever route it is, the computer doesn't know what the terrain's like. And so it might be that it's taking you right through a bog that you can't see. And
that's entirely likely in the Lake District.
Yeah, or it could be you're taking down. It might be there's one route that is really easy to run up versus down because of the underfooting, and you'd never want to do it down. So I don't know how much Paul's fed into that. But that interview is coming up. So stay tuned. It's only a year and a half late.
But it's still incredibly relevant. That's the thing. I mean, it's just, well, I've not listened to it for a year and a half, so maybe it's not relevant. But if we say, yeah, it's really relevant, and quite enthusiastically, you're sure to believe that listener.
And to be fair, we only interviewed him at the end of the summer because we didn't want to interview him at the time because he was being interviewed everywhere else. So we thought we'd catch up with him later and get a more rounded perspective on the challenge and Sabrina's attempt and various other things. So something to look forward to, for sure. But there's not been much happening to report on this week.
So I sent across to you a couple of news stories that caught my eye, which is unusual because normally when a running story comes across, when I come across a running story, I normally go, God, that's boring, and ignore it. But then the first one, it was about, people love a little bit of lockdown shaming. Love a bit of lockdown shaming, don't they? It's that element of self-righteousness that you get with runners, that even when someone's done something wrong, it's almost as though people are so self-righteous about it, I sometimes feel that I take the side of the person that's done wrong and gone, yeah, fucking yeah. So what if I broke?
But this the other day I was sat around with my big group of friends and we were bemoaning the number of people meeting up with other people. They're scum. They're scum.
It's when the people go, oh yeah, and I was walking through town and it was filled with people.
I took this photo to send to the press.
Yeah, exactly.
Of how many people.
I was walking out of town without my mask on and everyone else wasn't wearing a mask. Fucking ridiculous. But this one's pretty good. So it seems that the further away you are from London, the easier it is to kind of get away with breaking some of the protocols on lockdown.
We're talking about you, Australia.
Yes. Although I would imagine that Australia were breaking all sorts. Did you see those? Was it? I can't remember what beach it was at.
I think it's Bondi.
Was it Bondi? I'm not sure it was Bondi. I think it was another beach, but there was a massive party and they basically anywhere, I don't know whether it's just because it's the British press, but anywhere abroad where there is someone breaking some lockdown, it's always British people. Like they have that thing in that ski resort in Verbier, where basically they did a mass breakout. It sounded like something from Colditz or whatever, where they said, okay, we're all going into quarantine, and like 25 families all of a sudden disappeared from the hotel and no one could track them. And then the same thing's happened in Australia, that they're trying to track down all these like British people who basically went to this massive party at the height of lockdown. But this is in Cornwall. And you know, there's it's a difficult place to start. You know, they're in tier one. So there's still a lot of stuff allowed to happen in tier one, but they saw they had a half marathon in it says in Cornwall. That's rather vague as to exactly where in Cornwall was, but basically there was a mass start in Cornwall in this half marathon, 215 runners all starting at the same time, which I don't think has happened in a race for like at least like 12 months or something.
And was that an error or? Had they just not planned to do anything different?
It didn't have a staggered start. The race director said she believed she'd followed guidance and any breach was unintentional, which I think is a bit weird considering how precious race directors have been over it. You know, we've had like all these staggered starts coming. I mean, staggered starts are just kind of the thing that you have to do, and it's pretty obvious that if you are running any kind of race, I mean, it's what, 250 people, so it's not massive. It's not a massive race, but you know, it's enough to need a staggered start. But yeah, they just all set off at once.
Is the race organizer going to be fined, or what happens? Is this something where the council has jurisdiction, or the police have powers to retrospectively do something?
The council did say, according to this report, the council did say that the event was approved based on plans which included like wearing masks and social distancing and staggered start times, and then that didn't happen. And the organizer basically blamed the mixed message that's sent out by UK Athletics, which, to be fair, UK Athletics is useless. But I do think on this particular point, it seems weird that they kind of ignored it. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't say anything about how that works. Who's responsible for prosecuting in that case? Whether it's something around the council has to do something about it because it. You ran an event that wasn't in line with the plans that you submitted. I don't know, race directors, you must be able to tell us what. I haven't seen anything that suggests that they're going to be penalised for it.
Because I saw in November there was a race in the States, and we've mentioned staggered starts. This one wasn't a staggered start, but it was quite small. But also, I think race directors also have to consider staggered finishes. Now, it was in Alabama, and it's called the Running Lane National Cross Country Championships. And I understand America has quite a different view. I say America, a lot of people in America have quite a different view towards their approach to COVID and more of a denial kind of approach to their strategy.
I was like, you're being a bit coy about that. You mean like they don't believe it? Yes, okay.
But this race was a national championships, so incredibly fast. I don't fully understand the different codings for running lane or anything like that. Maybe that's a sponsor, but I think it's the university or the college national championship. But the trouble is, they all had 200 finishes within a minute because they're all so bloody quick. And so that's not something I've ever heard people discuss before, is staggered start. You know, you're standing there to begin all together, but actually at the finish, where you've been doing sprints to the line, you're massively heavy breathing. They had between something like 14:47, when it's a quick race, and 15:47, or 15 and 16. So, close to 200 finishes within a minute, and that is something that is. There's no way of getting around that fact that you have 200 people all breathing heavily with each other, probably celebrating a little bit, fist bumping close quarters.
These are elite runners. No one's fist bumping.
That's true. That's true.
Scowling at each other.
Yeah, or furious with their results. but it's not going to be common that something like that happens, but is that now a consideration people have to consider? But also, their cross country, wow, it was almost like running on a road. It was this beautiful grass that looked as good as a golf course, and it was pretty much a sprint. There's no woods, no muds, no undulation. Yeah.
I do think there is a lot that's... Whenever you see like American sort of US trail running or US cross country, it is so completely different. Like there's never the, like they say, the rain and the relentless mud and the, you know, the pained faces and everything that goes with it, which is really interesting because, you know, I was just thinking that must have been a real shock to the Americans when they came over for the OCR World Champs in Essex that time. Sorry, London.
Yeah. It's just such a different environment out there, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But then, talking about elites. So that was the other story that I saw, which I absolutely loved, which was the story around the Olympic team. So the British Olympic team basically sent out a little gift to all the Olympians and Paralympians over Christmas. And this gift to them wasn't a pack of EPO or anything else like that. Don't worry, we're not going down that route. It was like a toothbrush and some chocolate. And basically, their little message to them over the Christmas period was brush your teeth for Christmas. And you think, oh, that's a little bit patronising. But their whole idea was they know that when the athletes basically take a break over Christmas, it's when their guard kind of drops in terms of...
But they don't brush their teeth.
Well, no, it's not that they don't brush their teeth. It's just that some of the... They've worked out that one of the triggers for letting your personal hygiene go was not brushing your teeth, just like either not brushing your teeth first thing in the morning. And so what they did is they have accentuated that particular message about brushing their teeth so that it's one of, what is it called, like a, I can't remember what the term for it is, it's like a keystone trigger or something like that. It's one thing that if you do, it leads to lots of other things happening. And I think they've identified that, and if by pushing that message, it should remind them over the Christmas period to maintain their hygiene.
Are you sure they're not just sponsored by Colgate now?
Well, you think so, but here we are. Look, this is quite important. So I'm reading from the BBC report here. Athletes have been sent instructions to maintain their dental hygiene over the festive season in a bid to reduce lost training days. Now, this is amazing. In 2019, English Institute of Sport identified that across the 1,200 athletes they support, 100 training days were lost in the first 2 weeks of January. Previous scientists noticed a spike in illness, particularly coughs and colds, during this period and deduced it was because athletes became slightly more relaxed around the holidays. The main reason we're giving them, you know, this package is to give the athletes information that fundamentally reminded them to avoid illness over the Christmas period.
I mean, deduced is always a little bit of a woolly word.
It's their job, though. This goes back to that David Brailsford thing, doesn't it? Of incremental gains, like it's doing tiny things in order to do that. And so I wonder whether they're doing any of the other, you know, national athletic societies or anything else for associations for other countries are sending anything to their athletes over the Christmas period. Let's not mention the Russians. But you know, it makes you wonder whether they're thinking of this, because this has worked very successfully for cycling, and you know, it's obviously an approach that they're thinking about. They're actually Christmas crackers they sent out to them. They've got instructions on good oral hygiene and mouthwash to help them.
Because before the previous Olympics, they messaged out about not putting your toothbrush within a metre and a half of the toilet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the fear was that when you flush the toilet, all of your poo goes on your brush, goes in your mouth, and same thing. I don't know if that was then disproven, but that was one of their small changes, particularly their view was that when you went to hotels or you were traveling away to races, you're more likely to be in a crappy little room with a absolute box bathroom where you have no way of keeping your toothbrush out of that distance unless you put it in a cupboard or you put a top on it. And so that was one of their pearls of wisdom. And so I guess this is a continuation of that, is it's, we now believe that our athletes are trained so well to perfection.
I like this. It makes me wonder whether our athletes are actually all a bit shit and they're releasing this to give the impression that actually we've got to that, you know, these like incremental gain stage of doing this. And actually we're heading for an absolutely disastrous Tokyo Games when it happens.
We're blaming bad results on our terrible teeth. Again, the British stereotype haunting us.
The thing is, they can't blame bad hygiene anymore because, I mean, like... Yeah. This is the first time in history that I've been into, like, men's toilets, and I've actually seen men washing their hands before they leave the toilets after going to the toilet. So if most blokes are now, like, actually using proper hygiene protocols, then, you know, it shows you that the majority of the population is using, you know, proper hygiene protocols. So it's created a level playing field. So we can't say, oh, you know... you know, we can use the fact that we've got much better hygiene protocols and we're sterilizing stuff and we're making sure that we have antibacterial stuff, because that is just a fact of life now, and everyone should be doing that already. So it's almost taken out of it a variable that we said, you know, that we've got to blame it. If they're getting ill, it's got to be for another reason.
Yeah, I mean, and I've said previous years how much I've been impacted by boozing too heavily and getting ill over Christmas and New Year, and I've always ended up with 4 or 5 days of not being able to do any running whatsoever, which actually might do me some good, but I've always come out of New Year in a worse state than going into it.
That doesn't surprise me with you.
But I've got something that'll interest you. We love the nuances of rules, and
we love the breaking of rules. We love
the breaking of rules as well.
You can break them in a nuanced way.
But the trouble is now with world athletics and the world and definitions is how do you, where's the line in the rule and what's fair and what's not? So this one really interested me because I wasn't quite sure how I felt, like who was right, who was wrong. So there's a black Paralympian who has 2 blades. Yeah. And the governing body, the Court of Arbitration of the Sport, they've ruled previously on how long those blades should be. Because the longer they are, the longer your stride, faster you are.
Yeah.
Now, Blake Leeper is a American athlete, black athlete, and he is now saying that actually he's bringing into court the fact that it's a racist decision, a prejudice decision, because all of the statistics that they've had previously on what the equivalent of a lower limb in terms of performance of these aesthetics have been based purely on white and Asian people. And so he's saying that he's disadvantaged because as a black athlete, he has a different body type.
Yeah.
Which it's really interesting because it might be true, or it might be he's just trying to kind of get away with a nicer prosthetic.
What, wait a minute. So black and Asian. So, but what? So what is what? You're saying Caucasian and Asian. What measurements or statistics are what they're basing the length of the blade on?
So they've
where have those come from?
Those have come from analysis of previous athletes. So they've only included Australians, Spanish, Caucasians, and Asians from Japan. And I don't fully know how they've analysed what the right length should be, but maybe they just look at the translation of what your actual height is with the prosthetic, what your stride length is. That to me would make some kind of sense. I don't know if that's actually the case. And so he's saying that because he's a different build, because he's black,
yeah,
he should be allowed longer prosthetics because he's heavier.
That seems to me that seems entirely reasonable.
I don't know. I don't know if it is or not, because I think it only is entirely reasonable if it's shown that that all black males are genetically heavier or genetically taller or genetically whatever the reason is why his prosthetics should be longer.
So what? And, so where's this? How's this been left? Is it a case that he is? So has he gone to appeal and he's had his appeal rejected? Is that if it's arbitration?
So, you know, in the previous episode or future episode, I can't remember now. We've when we talk about the previous episode, when we talk about the Court of Arbitration in sport and how that sits supposedly independently of WADA and of the IOC, even though someone on its board is also the deputy of the Olympic Committee, I believe. So there are a Swiss body.
They come in on ice. Well, they're pretty ace.
they're an independent body in Switzerland, and they have ruled against him. So the only place he can go to now is to take it to a Swiss court, which is what he's now doing. My understanding is that you're incredibly unlikely to win that, because from reading about appealing because of drugs, which doping, which may be completely different to this, but I don't think it is you can only really, so like a speeding ticket, you can only really say that the ruling, you can only appeal on grounds of kind of technical problems or things not being put into court in the right manner, or so you're bringing them up in a technicality rather than the reasoning behind the decision.
Right, okay.
But it's really interesting the way that it's been used in this way as discrimination based on colour en masse. And it could be true that they should have, you know, black people should have different lengths for their prosthetics. But then how do you, given that we can now DNA test, should Dutch people have different ones as well because they're the tallest people on earth as a nation? Or should we then have shorter prosthetics for countries where
are the prosthetics like the blades, are they like all the same length for all the athletes in all the when you compete? I don't know anything about this.
There's a limit,
it's between certain levels and stuff. So like if you say, and does it depend on what you're doing? So if you say, like, if you run a 200 meters, you have blades of a certain length, or you have the same blades, or are the blades based on your height, or is that,
I don't think it depends
on what.
But the way these have been defined, no one's ever sat down from the start and said, right, let's create a clear set of rules that are fair for everyone. These things always evolve.
Yeah.
In the same way the Fosby flop came along, and like, are we allowed to do that? It's a different way of jumping the high jump. It wasn't against the rules because no one had thought of it. And so this goes back. It was first a case when Oscar Pistorius wanted to compete in the Olympics, and there was a big argument about whether he should be allowed to compete, because the suggestion was he was actually getting an unfair advantage because his prosthetics were so good.
Yeah.
I still think that's the case from just looking at his body mass and various other things. I just don't think someone who had his body mass and body type would have been as quick as a 400 meter runner. But that's an aside. That then determined the rules, and you then have to appeal or argue against the set rules. So they then did a study after that, but it only used athletes that were running in dual prosthetic limbs. So they had a limited data set, and that's his argument. And yeah, okay. And I can't see him winning. And but I also don't know if that's good or bad, because I don't know if it is racist or prejudiced. Oh, I see. Or whether
so they based the other data sets on other athletes with prosthetic limbs, which is where they've got the data set from. Okay, no, that makes sense, because I was thinking, well, it's weird, why Australia's like Spain and Japan. It's always just a weird. It's just like, okay, all right, okay. So that, okay, no, that makes sense. Yeah,
but I can imagine this is going to be a really this case and the way the nuances are when it comes to transgender people in sport.
I was just saying that the next issue is transgender, isn't it? That's the
absolutely
that's, yeah.
And that's going to be the issue there, is that they will have to define a set of rules, and then those rules are changed by people challenging and arguing them in court. And so I can see, because whatever rule we make, there's going to be someone who's screwed over, Caster Semenya, for example. And so the next 30 years, what I think that's going to be the weekly
topic. The battleground will be in the courts rather than in the labs in the courts rather than the on the track.
Yeah, and similarly, there's a victim and a winner on whatever the decision. It's just where that line is drawn and how you sit on that line. And unfortunately for Blake, he now has to have the shorter prosthetics in line with everyone else. But then it's in line with everyone else. So, yeah. What do you think, Dubad? Does anyone have any knowledge on this, any experience, fairly unlikely, or any strong views on it? And is there any other way that we can get to fair decisions other than having to go to court? Probably not, but what are your views? Let us know. Let us at badboyrunning.com.
It's weird, isn't it? Because, like, I think the one thing that's been shown throughout, and this is, look how I'm relating this, throughout this pandemic, is that, it used to be the case when people said, oh, follow the science. Like, if we follow the science, that'll give us the answer. Mm. But what people have realised that, and I think, this has really shown up, is that the science doesn't give the answer. The science gives you the data, and you still have to interpret it and make decisions based on the science. And those decisions can be wildly different depending on who you are and how you're making that and what you're responsible for, whether you're responsible for public policy, whether you're responsible for public health. Because we've got the same data coming through and wildly different decisions, even experienced in sort of the SAGE committees, between the government one and the independent one. And so following the science and using science, thinking that the science is going to answer these questions has to come down to policymakers and people making political decisions, essentially.
Yeah. And that's what we've been seeing with Corona as well, is that you can say follow the scientists, and I do have a lot of sympathy for the government in that it's very hard to please everyone, but also the government isn't making laws just based on what's best for society, but what's based on society based on the science. They've also got to look at when people are going to follow rules and when they can't, and they have to try and maintain the facade that they're in control, and they don't want to turn everyone into unruly lawbreakers.
I think that's the other thing about the corona thing, is that people keep forgetting that behavioral economics are a big part of that compliance it's all very well. The thing I thought was really interesting about the pandemic is that it's shown that you have different groups of friends who you never realized that they're what they were really like. There's some people who were like such strict authoritarians that they want like the hardest lockdown possible and the hardest penalties for anyone that ever steps out of line. And you kind of look at them and go, I didn't realise you were quite like that.
I'd say all my friends have actually acted in line with what I'd expect.
But no, there's a lot of people who are complete conspiracy theory nutcases, which some of them are really surprising. A lot of family, you're like, I always knew you were kind of like that. But there are a lot of people who I, previously respected, who come out as proper, anti-vaxxer, nutcase, 5G, Bill Gates is, the Great Reset. You're just like throwing shit out now. It's ridiculous. But there's some people who come out and they like absolutely love living the idea that someone's setting some rules for them. It's almost liberated them, that they don't have to go out. They don't have, they're forced to live, within these kind of like almost authoritarian means. And they seem to be thriving on the fact that they don't have to make decisions anymore. It's really interesting.
But can all the anti-vaxxers, it's obviously a different view if you...
Just fuck off.
can you write a letter to yourself or write something on Facebook saying, I believe in anti-vaxxing for this. If in 2 years' time you've all been vaccinated and it's made a huge difference to Corona, I agree to change my mind.
Well, no, I keep thinking this whole anti-vaxxer thing is actually, because I get, you know, you have this idea that evolution has stopped working. Evolution has stopped working because, you know, so many people survive. Medical science has got such a point that people just don't really die of stuff. Like, normally when someone would die of stuff. But it's moved into the realms of now evolution has taken over. There is a genetic predisposition of, if you believe in anti-vaccine, you're not going to take the vaccine, which makes you more susceptible to pandemics, which means that you're more likely to die. So actually the situation is that eventually people who are more skeptical of science are going to be the ones that aren't going to be able to procreate, because they're the ones that are going to die out in the pandemics.
Interesting. Yet true. So you're saying, for the sake of Darwin, we should not treat people in hospital who've not had the vaccine?
Who don't believe in the vaccine, because they won't want to be treated anyway. They're going to refuse it anyway. So if they're going to refuse it, they're going to die out, because, of course, you know, there's going to be other pandemics that are going to be a lot worse than this. And so they're always going to... I wonder, you know, in the face of a pandemic that is much more deadly, like a SARS or an Ebola or something like that, how much their anti-vax rhetoric is maintained in that situation. Because I'd like it if they, you know, if we suddenly had like an Ebola breakout and like, you know, the death rate was like 80%, and, you know, and they rock up to their to the local surgery to get the thing, and they're like, oh, it's funny because I was looking at your social media from a couple of years ago. Remember that?
You know how my kid caught measles because of your child not being
exactly
vaccinated.
Yeah, I distinctly remember that you saying that this was a conspiracy theory, and now you've come in for this. And unfortunately, we can't give this to you anymore. No.
Yeah. Well, you heard it here first, people. When a Ebola breaks out,
it's the bad boy theory of evolution.
And we are sponsored by Health England, Good Health England today, Good Health, and the World Health Organization.
They're
giving us free vaccines.
Bill Gates is giving us free vaccines to hand out. What I don't understand is why people think like Bill Gates would go to such an extent. Like, Bill Gates is one of the persons who's almost single-handedly responsible for eradicating smallpox in Africa. Yet, why create this entirely new thing?
But what about big pox? What about big pox?
Smallpox, it wasn't a big enough pox for us. That's why we got rid of it. We want giant pox. But why go to the extent of creating a virus so they could inject us with a vaccine, which apparently changes our DNA and turns us into 5G broadcasting towers to find out what's on the cloud, when anyone could pretty much go and find out what we're doing anyway right now based on like the data that they have? Like, if they wanted to track us, you know, like in China, they can track everyone all the time anyway, and they don't even hide it. Like, why? It just seems like the most confused, like Macintoshian, like, way of
what if
of
they're
control.
Right, Jenny? What if they're right?
What if they're right? Well, if they're right, I will freely admit it. But, you know, how do you know that we're just not a mouthpiece for Bill Gates? All of a sudden, you've got the Gates Foundation sponsoring us. And we will take... I tell you, we will take sponsorship from the Gates Foundation if they do want sponsors.
But you're actually going to take something that's not Apple.
What?
You're going to have something that's not Apple in your life. This is a groundbreaking moment.
I will take. I didn't think about that, actually.
Anyway, let's segue to our next guest, who had to eat an apple while he was doing the incredible Wainwright. Take it away, Nick.
Hey,
Okay, dude, Ballard, you've got an absolute treat for you. We talked about this last year, but we never talked about it extensively. And most of you know about the rounds, the Bob Graham rounds. But we've never talked about the Wainwrights before. So to come on the podcast and explain to us what it is, just how incredibly hard it is and how incredibly well he's done at it. Welcome to the podcast, Paul Tierney. Yay! How you doing?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very good, very good. How long have you been in the Lake District for then?
I will be here 6 years in October, but I also lived here a year before that as well, separately. So I'll be almost 7 years total, with a short stint back in Ireland after that first year. So yeah, it's been a fair chunk of time now. It's kind of passed by pretty quickly.
And what came first? Did your love of kind of trail and fell running come first, or the Lake Districts? Do you like which cause which?
I think the fell running, trail running side of things came first, but very quickly because of that sport, then, you know, my attention was drawn to the Lake District because I'm sure I had heard of it living in Ireland, but you know, when you're not into the hills or it's not part of your life, then it doesn't have the same you wouldn't have the same appreciation for it, you know. So as soon as I started getting involved in trail running and fell running, that very quickly came on my radar, because obviously, you know, the history of the whole sport and books like Richard Asquith's book Feet in the Clouds, that was brilliant book in terms of advertising the sport in the Lake District. Once I'd read that, I was quite keen to maybe see the place. And then Mark Laithwaite's race, the Lakeland 100, sort of had, I think it just started, was it 2008 or 9 that started? And that was around the time I got into the sport. And, you know, I just thought, what a place to do a 100-mile race like that. It's basically a big tour of the Lake District. So I came and did that in 2011. That was my first time ever being in the lakes. And it was, you know, immediately sort of drawn to the place after that, wanted to come back. So.
And did you move specifically, like, was it a coincidence, or you moved because you wanted to run there and to be surrounded by it?
At that time when I first came over, I was still in the police, or the guards, the Garda, they call them in Ireland. So I sort of, you know, was very, very heavily involved and interested in running and competing at that point. And when I came over and did the race, I you know, I was just kind of thinking to myself that there's more to life. You know, I might like to try it for maybe a year, and I inquired about getting a career break from the guards, and I managed to get that. So it was purely to come live here and try it out for a year, you know, first, and you know sample the place and you know, just do whatever work I could get initially and see what happened. So it was the running that drew me here mainly, and it just so happened coincidentally that I met Sarah, my partner, just, you know, a few months before I moved, and she was living in Scotland at the time, and her mum's side of the family are from the Lake District, so it sort of fitted nicely.
Is there such a thing as the Fell Police? It sounds like a great 1970s TV show. You could go running around catching sheep hustlers and rustlers even. Is it easy to get a job after the police?
I'm not sure how many or how big a problem sheep rustlers are up here. So.
David's shown his knowledge of the area as usual.
there are actual police up here, so I did inquire about doing that job over here. Initially when I first came over, but at the time I wasn't I was on this career break, and I wasn't willing to resign from the Irish police at the time, so I didn't really pursue it. And I just wanted to get any job I could, really, to start with. And it wasn't for the work I was coming, really, you know what I mean? It was for the running. So I ended up actually in a running shop in Keswick, and did that for about 8 months, and then moved to Pete Bland's, which is an institution here in the Lake District, to Pete Bland Sports. So I was Matt kindly gave me a job for the last 4 months of that year that I was here. And that was great working there. The job was real small, and it was just me and one other person, and it wasn't the most fun in the world. Whereas, to be fair to Matt and his staff, they were lovely, and I really enjoyed working with them. And I'm still, you know, Matt lives here in Windermere as well. I still meet Matt regularly, and he's a great guy. So that made it a bit easier. But then I had decided then late on in that year to go. You know, to go back, I had to go back anyway. To the career break was finished, so I was a bit torn. I suppose I kind of wanted to go back to Ireland, but I didn't really want to leave the Fells, and it was a real sort of torn between the two, really, when I left, which is why I ended up back here 10 months later again. So,
and what? Because we've spoken to a few people who moved to the Fells. I mean, is it like, what is it that really draws you? Is it the people in the community? Is it the way of life, or is it just that ability? Is it like the racing, or just the ability to just run on those hills every day?
There's certainly you can have the just the stunning scenery and more rugged actually in many places in Ireland, some, like, great places to run. But I suppose the access to the land is a bit different, so it is a bit harder to, you know, around here you can do something like the Lakeland 100 and do it almost completely on trail. There's a little bit of road, but you know, you're basically, because of all the rights of way and the bridleways and footpaths and stuff, you can kind of join things up much easier. Whereas in Ireland, there would be access issues in places, and it's great in some ways because it's very, very remote in places, and you can you might meet no one when you're out in the hills. But equally, you're on private land at times, or you're jumping over barbed wire fences trying to find a bit of a trod to the top of a hill, and that can be difficult. So I think that's what the Lakes has going for it, is the access to the land, and then obviously the community is very condensed. I suppose there's so many people involved in the same activities, whether it's fell running, walking, climbing, mountain biking, whatever it is. So there is a real, it's like, I kind of thought when I moved here, I thought I was the one with this great idea to move, and that, you know, no one else would have the same idea. But of course, half the people living here, this place, like, I thought I was way smarter than everyone else coming up here. But, so you're meeting like-minded people who aren't necessarily from here, who have come because they love the outdoors and they want to be involved in that community. And I suppose that makes it a very nice place to live. And it means that you've got loads of races on from one end of the week to the next when you're allowed to have races, and you've got plenty of people to train with. We've got a great club, Ambleside AC, are a brilliant, brilliant club that have a nice, healthy kind of balance between being serious and being, you know, liking going for pints after training and races. And I like that about the club, and very, very welcoming club as well. And lots of friends from that club, you know, would make it quite difficult for me to want to move away, that's a long-winded answer to say it's probably the community and the access to the land.
And were you fairly competitive before you moved there, like when you did the Lakelands 100, you know, were you a top fell runner even back then?
I don't think I've ever been a top bell runner, but I suppose in a race like the Lakeland 100, where, you know, realistically there might be 5 to 10 runners who are racing the race, I mean, the ultimate goal is to finish it, because there's never any guarantee of finishing a race that long. But I could be competitive in a race like that, whereas I'd be a bit further back in something like UTMB or something on the international stage. So I know my own a bit. I'm fairly in tune with my own ability. I'm all right, but I'm not. I'm certainly not a top fell runner, nor was I ever a top fell runner. So it's probably, I actually prefer the shorter, you know, 10 mile to kind of 15 mile fell race, or even shorter than that, you know, because they're over real quick. It's a real hard blast up a hill and real fast down any which way you like. And I love that about fell running. It's my favorite type of running. But I'm not, certainly not at the front of any of those races, unless, you know, no one else turns up and I'm
do you think are you drawn to the longer challenges then, because of, is it the fact that you do better at it, or is it something else that draws you?
Initially it wasn't that I would be better at it that drew me. It was this thing of, well, could you actually do that? It looks like a bit of an adventure. And it's, you know, it started out being like a 30 mile fell race or hill race in Ireland that I was trying to do. And I didn't care where I finished. I just wanted to be able to say I'd done it, or wanted to be able to see if I could do it. And that was the attraction initially. And then you realize that, you know, realistically, probably because the competition isn't the same as doing your, you know, a local 5K road race where there'll be lots of fast guys who've been running all their lives. So you the competition isn't necessarily as strong, therefore you end up being towards the front of the race, and then you think, oh well, maybe I could do a bit better, and that draws you in, I suppose. And so then it did become about doing a bit better, I guess. And that was obviously a nice side benefit, or a kind of a motivator to keep, you know, looking for a new race or challenge. And I'd be lying if I said, you know, the standard, certainly when I was starting out doing these races and the particular races I was doing, the standard wasn't really, really high, and therefore I could do a bit better.
And when did something like the Wainwrights prick your interest?
Really, when I first heard about the way, I can't remember, was it because Steve was doing it first in 2014, or I think had read, there's a book, nice big hardback book with loads of nice pictures of the Fells and Joss Naylor's various different exploits, and I remember reading that book, and I think it was mentioned in that book, or it was maybe something else that was mentioned about Joss doing it. And so then in 2014, Steve, when he had said he was doing it, that sort of brought it to the forefront again. And I followed that from home. I was back in Ireland at the time when Steve was doing it, but I followed it, you know, like everyone else, wondering how he would get on. And I knew who Steve was then, but I didn't know him personally. And I knew that was the type of thing he would be, you know, brilliant at. And I just remember thinking, Christ, there's no way I could ever do that. It's just way beyond, it's just lunacy. You know, it's too long, and it's too, look at the state of him after 5 days. He's so sore, and you know, he's putting himself through such misery, and you just think, well, I wouldn't be able to do it. But then you get more experience as you go along, and, you know, you do some longer races, and you realize that you sort of bridge the gap between the 100 mile race and something like the Wainwrights, and you sort of do an intermediary kind of long race, and that gives you a bit of, you sort of start wondering then, well, maybe I could try something like that. And it was doing Tour de Jeans in the Alps that kind of gave me an inkling that maybe it would be worth at least trying. And I knew, when I was first thinking about doing the Wayne Rides, I knew there was a pretty good chance I wouldn't be able to do it, or I would get injured or just, you know, give up or whatever else. I knew there was a good, you know, decent chance that could happen. But something like Tour de Jans gave me a bit of confidence and, yeah, like I say, it bridged the gap. It made me think, well, it's worth a try at least. Yeah. So.
And when you mentioned that you were watching his attempts, like it's so rare that someone goes for something like this. What happened in the community in the build up to it? Like, did Steve and do you tell everyone, or does it just get round? Is everyone aware? Like, is there a buzz in the whole of the Lake District? Or
when I was watching Steve, I suppose I'd only lived there for a year, so I wouldn't have known as many people as I know now, and so maybe I didn't experience I wasn't aware of as big a buzz maybe because I was living in Ireland, and but I could see, you know, you see the people who were out with him in photos or little bits of video or whatever, and recognize the faces from races, and there was lots of well-known local runners and from the wider fell running scene and involved in it, and there was a bit of you could tell there was a buzz about it being attempted, you know, and because of Steve's reputation, then I think if no one knew who Steve was, then maybe there wouldn't have been as much interest, because, you know, maybe people wouldn't have expected much to come of the attempt. But because it was Steve and it was going to be a real serious attempt, and because he was aiming at, you know, taking half a day off Joss's record, I think that really got everyone's attention, and there was a bit of a buzz. And I suppose when I was doing it, like, it would have been nice to maybe not make a big song and dance of it, on the radar a bit, but I did have to tell quite a few people because I wanted them to help me. And then Innovate were being quite good to me and, you know, supplying me with all the kids. So they obviously wanted to tell people. No, they didn't force me to you know, be telling people, but you have to be a bit of give and take, I suppose. I'd have liked to put no pressure on myself and just do it quietly, but I knew that there was benefits of putting a bit of that pressure on as well, and you know, got more people interested in helping out as well, and that was obviously important. I needed all that help. If I didn't have that help, I'd have, you know, fucked it up completely right from the start. I needed good people around me who are, you know, good in the fells and good navigators and good, you know, people who knew what the right thing to say was at certain times when you're just dead on your feet. And I wanted to surround myself with people like that, because that would, you know, give me a bit of confidence as well and keep my spirits up. Like, so I suppose making a little bit of a song and dance of it had its benefits. It's just
And if you were to say going into it, like what percentage of it was going for completion and what percentage of it was going for the record? Like, was it an all out attempt at the record, or was that more of a motivation to help you just get round quickly and you'd have been fairly happy with just finishing?
Yeah, like, I suppose because I maybe have been, if I go back and think about, say, doing Tour de Jans, I've probably been guilty of being a bit too conservative at times in that race, maybe sleeping a bit too much because, you know, there was a bit of an unknown factor, not knowing whether you'd manage without much sleep and whatever else. And my ultimate goal then had to be, or at the very least, I wanted to finish. So I was going to, you know, play it safe a little bit. And that probably was the case with the Wainwrights too. I didn't take too many risks, I guess, because ultimately I wanted to finish it, and if it was going to be slower than Steve's time, so be it. I didn't care. Once I started, I wanted to at least finish the thing. So however, that said, like, I did make a schedule to do about 6 days. Now, it was there wasn't a whole pile of science went into the schedule. It was just like I looked at what Steve did, and I reasoned that hopefully I'd be able to move as quick as him. So I just needed to rest less and that would make my time up. And that's sort of what happened. You know, I didn't move much quicker than him. Steve loves analyzing the things and he does a really good job of it. So he looked at it after, and I think I was moving maybe 90 minutes only quicker than he did, but I had whatever it was, 6 hours or five and a half or 6 hours less rest than he did. So that's where I made my time up. And that's how you have to play it. I think, like, I look back on it now and think, oh, I could have maybe done a quicker time, but it's easy to say that in hindsight. I wanted to, once I had consolidated a bit of a gap, I wanted to hold on to that and not mess it up. So I look back on it and think, well, the last night I stopped in the van for 3.5 or 4 hours, whereas if I had been under pressure for more time, maybe I could have gotten out of the van after an hour and gone again, you know what I mean? But you don't know what that effect or what that's going to have, what kind of an effect that's going to have on your body. And it's a real fine line between getting enough rest and going, because if you are dead on your feet and you're just stumbling about the place like a zombie, then obviously you're not going to be moving well. So you have to balance the two. And I think, you know, once I had that few hours gap, I was sort of happy to try and just maintain that.
And do you think now there's more kind of fat on the sleeping than there is on the speed, if someone's going to break it?
I guess it depends on the person, because you know, I can think of people who are better athletes and quicker runners than me who may be very well be very suited to doing something like this, and if they were to try it, then maybe they could go in with a bit more of a schedule that allowed them to or that allowed for moving a bit quicker, because they're simply better than me, you know. And I suppose it's about weighing up your own strengths. And if I was going back to do it again, I would gamble a bit more with the sleep and maybe have a bit less rest. It doesn't mean it would work, but you know, I'd try it. And I think if you're someone who's quicker than me, then maybe you could move quicker and just rest roughly the same, or maybe just a little bit less. So the record will be broken, obviously. Like, someone's going to come along and break it, and I'm not stupid. I know that's going to happen. But I, you know, I'd like to hang on to this for a bit longer.
And so going to your preparation then, once you decided that you were going to go for the record, how long did you have to train, and what was your approach?
So I probably decided until, say, January of last year, so it would have been 6 months ish before the attempt. I had previously met Steve, went and met Steve the year before that, so the January beforehand, when I was thinking about doing it that year in 2018. And I suppose I gave it a lot of thought. Steve gave me lots of advice, and I kind of made up my mind to hold off a year and get an experience and give myself a bit more time. So I suppose there was that year as well of you know, sort of thinking through it as well. But when I firmly decided to do it, would have been 6 months out. So that gave me, you know, my plan was to try and recce a good portion of the route, and that was going to be, that would be mostly my long runs, and see how much of the route I could cover that way. Like, logistically, if you're doing it on your own, it's a bit tricky with cars and, you know, getting from A to B and trying to string a full leg together. So I had lots of help from my friend here, lives just up the road, Neil McKenzie, and he works in Iraq, so he's a month in Iraq and he's a month at home, so his wife can't stick him, so she lets him go recce him with me when he comes home from work. So
what does he do in Iraq?
He's with, used to be in the military. He surveys landed, I think, in bomb disposal, stuff like that. So he, so I think he's working with Shell out there. So they do surveying of land and old explosion.
I guess he's got lots of good stories to tell you as well when you're kind of stuck up those fells. Long distance run, he brings out a tale or two.
We can't tell half those stories here. he's really good, really good company, good fun, and he was really, really interested. That was the most important thing. He was like a massive help to me because he was so keen to get out with me, and that made it a bit easier with the logistics as well. So he did, I don't know exactly how much of the recce he did with me, but he did at least half, probably more, with me at various times. So and then, you know, looking through the route to see if we could come up with a better option for various parts of it. So obviously the route, it starts and finishes at Moot Hall in Keswick, but it's up to you how you join the fells up. So to save myself a fair bit of time, I took Steve's route, and I mean, it was essentially the very same. There was one or two little tweaks we did, not like very few, but Neil was constantly looking for a better option, and he would text me and tell me that he thought he'd found a better option, and then 2 minutes later he'd text back and say, oh no, fuck it, forget it, it doesn't work. And that happened a fair bit before the attempt, but you know, I think having someone like Neil who was that interested, it almost gave me, you know, you feel a little bit guilty about, like this was something that was fairly, not selfish, but I was benefiting from doing it, or stoking my ego or whatever, I don't know, whatever you call it. It was a personal thing. I wasn't helping anyone, you know, necessarily by doing it. So the fact that he was keen to be involved and help made me feel less guilty about getting other people involved, I guess. It was made it easier. And then there was obviously, like, Neil helped in the initial wrecking, but then he was actually in Iraq when the attempt happened. So there was so many other people involved over the course of the week. A lot of people who, like, I had a core group of supporters who I knew who had volunteered and I had asked, and, you know, I knew who was going to be there throughout the week, but so many other people came out, you know, of their own. People just in the middle, you know, there was Mars bars left on top of fells. There was not positive. We were Binsey down the road from Binsey, and this farmer came up the road on a quad bike and had a cooler box, and he had bought us ice lollies. And this, you know, out of nowhere, I don't even know if he, I didn't know who he was or anything. Like, he'd obviously heard what was going on, and I thought that was pretty good of him. and then the core group of people I had involved throughout the whole week, so we had like about, I think it was six or seven people who were heavily involved throughout the week with planning, logistics. Tori from Innovate, and I'll forget people if I start mentioning, but like the amount of help you got, sort of, it was another motivator to keep going when you were a bit knackered, because these people had basically just given their whole life over to this attempt for the week and the few weeks before. And so if you were going to give up, it would have been pretty, you know, disrespectful or shit on those people. So,
because are there rules about what is allowed and what isn't allowed? So this is, just for the listener who doesn't know, it's 318 miles, 214 peaks, 36,000 meters of ascent. So basically four times up Everest.
And the rules are, so I was doing it supported. So what that means is you move under your own steam between the hills. You have people who can run with you so they can navigate for you and they can carry your food and water. And you have every at the end of each leg, so each section of hills, there would be a road crossing or something like that where we had a van parked up where we could restock food and meet the new group of pacers and go to sleep in the evening in the van. So it was that they're sort of the rules, I guess, you know, as long as you're doing it under your own steam and you have navigational support. So like my navigation is not brilliant, but it's a lot better than it used to be. But when you're 3 days into something like that and you're just, the eyes are hanging out of your head, navigating is the last thing you want to be doing. So I made sure I had good people who knew the area and were really reliable on each leg. And that was a massive confidence boost. You know, I never really had to worry about making a wrong turn. There was some bad weather where, you know, we couldn't really see our hands in front of our faces. And it's in those kind of, at those times where things could go wrong and you could lose a lot of time. So I didn't really have to worry about that, which was great.
And so, but before we go into kind of more detail on the attempt itself, then did you have a rigid training plan you're actually following? Like, what kind of mileage were you doing in the build up to it, and what did those miles look like?
Pretty much all my miles were on the fells, unless there was, you know, a mile or two here and there getting onto a fell, so on, you know, a couple of miles from the car on the road or something like that. But it was basically all on the fells. I think I was averaging maybe 70 to 85 miles a week, closer to 85, 90. You know, in the peak of it, but generally like 70 to 80 each week, most weeks from January onwards, and lots and lots of ascent. So I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 meters of ascent, maybe a bit more in those higher mileage weeks, and there wasn't a whole pile of there wasn't anything sophisticated about the training. It was just lots of time on feet, some harder runs, you know, hill rep sessions, carrying a bit extra weight for those longer days in a pack. Sort of trying to get back-to-back long runs as the year went on, trying to get some double or triple long run days. So just to try and have that build up of fatigue in the legs and getting up and going again the next day, you know. So
and was it all generally running, or because I know, for example, Damien Hall does a lot of hiking and Jasmine as well in her prep. Did you mix in hiking to your training, or were you trying to run as much as possible?
No, yeah, there was loads of hiking. Yeah, it was like if I'm out for a long 5 or 6 hours on the fells and I'm trying to go at, you know, maybe a little quicker than the attempt pace, then invariably that's going to be, if we're going uphill, most of that's going to be hiking. And then you're trotting nice and comfortably on the flats and downs. I suppose I was going out, I wasn't thinking about whether it was a hike or a run. It was just getting from A to B. And if that meant hiking in places, then yeah, that's what it was. The attempt itself, if you were to kind of break it down into percentages of hiking and running, it's probably a massive amount of it is hiking. You know, I wasn't running any of the steep hills. You were hiking all of those, you know, and then trying to comfortably jog along on the flats and the downs. So you're trying to limit the amount of damage, I suppose, in the downhill. So there was no point absolutely hammering yourself on the downhills, because you had, well, yeah, like 6.5 days of that in your legs. So you needed to be real careful with that. So it's about moving as efficiently as you could, really.
And did you have a specific date in mind the whole time? Because are you able to try and adapt to a nice weather window, or is the thinking that actually it's going to be bad weather at some point, no matter what? So let's just pick a date and go with it.
Yeah, that was sort of my feeling, the latter there. Like, I picked the date. I can't remember now. Was it the 15th of June? It was sometime. Yeah, I think it was around the 15th, and it was purely because that was going into the longest day of the year, so it was the most sunlight, or at least around that time. So there was 2 weeks after there was something on that I could, you know, I needed to be somewhere. I can't even remember now what it was. And the week before there was something else on, and it happened to be the 1 week where the calendar was sort of free. Sarah was around as well. She was doing a lot of racing last year, and she was going over and back to the Alps to race. So she wanted to obviously be there. And that was 1 week where she was at home. So between that and the daylight that we had, it sort of came down to that week. And because I did have a lot of support and a lot of people lined up to help on that particular week, there was no real wiggle room for moving the date. Once we committed to that date, I was sort of in my head thinking, yeah, hopefully we'll have some good weather, but realistically we're going to have some bad weather as well. And it was more hope than anything else, you know. So I think if you maybe had a little bit less organization, if you were doing it with less people involved, maybe it would be a bit more flexible to move the date around. But I felt like it wasn't really an option.
And did you have someone with you for every hour then?
Yeah, so the initial plan was to have 2 to 3 people with me on each leg, so someone who would have to carry all the food and drink and spare kit, and then someone to navigate, and then maybe a spare person if we had someone. So that was generally the way it worked out. But then you had people who asked would it be all right to jump in, and or there was points where I'd maybe asked people to be involved, and then it turned out that I had enough people on a particular leg, but I didn't want them not to be involved because they were keen to help. So then, you know, that we ended up with another person on a leg. So there was times where there might have been 5 or 6 people with us, and you know, obviously we didn't need to have 5 or 6. It was like, it wasn't that I was, you know, this diva that wanted
some of your hair.
Entourage.
So I could, I would have liked to, if it had been maybe a little bit more low key, but it was great that people actually were keen to be involved in it, you know, and like when someone popped up unexpectedly, that was a massive boost as well. And
how long would they typically run with you? Did you break it down into kind of 3-hour chunks, or was it very much dependent on the individual?
It was so the way the route that Steve designed works, there was 24 sections, and each section I had a new, you know, group of pacers. So some of those sections were quite short. There's a local, my 2 closest Wainwrights to where I'm living here, that little section was only, there was only 2 hills on it, and they were quite close together. It's only I think it was less than 2 hours, that section. But then on average you were talking 6 to 8 hours per leg if you were moving all that time. So
so that's actually, I mean, that is quite a challenge to find, because you've got to have people who've got time and who are fit as well to be able to do a 6 to 8 hour leg in itself is quite a lot for runners.
Well, I suppose it is and it isn't. Like if the pace wasn't going to be a problem for them, because I was obviously not moving very fast, so generally speaking the pace was going to be okay. Sometimes I was moving quite well on the uphills, and if they were carrying kit it might have been slightly more difficult for them, but in general the pace wasn't really an issue for them, as far as I know. So given the, I mean, where we're living, there is that many people who are keen to come out and help. And obviously there were some people who couldn't come at certain times, like, you know, school teachers who were still in school, and people with 9-to-5 jobs who maybe couldn't come out during the day, but would be available then for a night leg or an evening leg. So it generally worked out that anyone who wanted to be involved and who I wanted to be involved, there was a way of working them into it. And some people did more than one leg. You know, Joe Mann, who was involved in the pre-attempt like preparation as well, he did, I think he did 60-odd Wainwrights, so over the course of various different legs, so he did quite a lot. And then there was other people who did multiple legs as well. So generally speaking, everyone, it worked into people's schedules. There was no one too put out, as far as I don't think so anyway, you know.
And does the terrain alter much across that distance? Because, you know, they're all up high, they're all fairly close, but is there actually, does it change from Wainwright to Wainwright?
Yeah, like on day one, you do Lattrig. You start with Lattrig and then you come back on yourself and head, sort of, there's a little spine of hills, say, between Thirlmere and Borrowdale, which I generally would never go up. It's just, it's a bit out of the way, and it's really, really boggy up there, and it's not the most inspiring. It's lovely, actually. Sorry, I don't mean it's not inspiring, but it's they're sort of lesser traveled, if you know what I mean. And that was really, really boggy. And then you finish that section, that first leg, and you end up in Borrowdale, and suddenly you're into, you know, the proper central fells with the rocky classic Lake District look to them.
So were you changing trainers then? I know you mentioned you're sponsored by Innovate. Were you changing trainers from area to area, or to try and match?
I didn't really need to change the type of shoe, so I did have a few pairs of the same shoe, you know what I mean? So I could take off a wet, boggy, knackered pair and put on a nice, fresh, clean pair to keep my feet relatively dry and dry them off. But generally speaking, I was wearing a fell shoe, you know, a stud, the big studs that had lots of grip. So they work well, obviously, on boggy, slippy stuff. But to be honest, they work pretty good on rock as well. So they're a good mix of what you need on the fells. And there was occasions then later on in the attempt where it maybe was a little bit drier and my feet were needing maybe a little bit more cushion, and I wore a more typical kind of trail shoe with a bit less grip.
Which ones were they? I mean, you're allowed to mention them. Don't worry about that.
The shoe I wore most of the time was the Cross Talon Ultra 260. That's what it's called. And they have big, big lugs, really, really good grip. And the more hard pack kind of trail type shoe was the Terra Ultra 260. And they've just brought out a new version of that shoe, which is, I know this sounds like fucking advertisement, but they are a very nice shoe. They are genuinely my favorite shoe so far that they've made for that type of terrain. So they're good shoes for this type of terrain, really.
And how did you change during those 6 days? Like, were there, could you, looking back now, almost break it into different stages of how you felt, how you were moving?
I just got grumpier and grumpier. I was obviously really, really glad. Like when I started, in the build up, the few days before, I was suffering a bit with hay fever and really, really bad. I think it was hay fever, and a really, really bad dose of it, and just felt my breathing was a bit funny and just was clogged up and just a bit knackered and everything else. And so I was a bit nervous and apprehensive even starting out. And the night before, I didn't sleep very well. I maybe slept for about an hour. I was just tossing and turning, worried about this whole attempt. And then as soon as I started, all that just kind of went into the background. So the first day was just relief and happiness to be started. And you know, I was relatively fresh as well, so generally feeling quite good. And then the second day, it was still relatively fresh. So, you know, I was tired from not having much sleep in that kind of 24-hour period. But I had some really good pacers over the Western Fells. You know, some of it quite difficult terrain, but local guys who knew it really, really well. And I had great crack with those guys. So the mood was still pretty good. And I suppose it was going into this, like the second evening where sleep, you know, you're hitting about the 100-mile mark on that second evening and just sort of starting to get a bit sleep deprived and like fuzzy headed, you know, you almost like not being 100% there, and so you know, there's a tendency to get a little bit grumpy when that happens. And and I remember waking up on the Sunday morning, which would have been the third day, and just having this kind of hotness, you know, I suppose inflammation and swelling in my legs, and feeling just definitely a bit knackered. But it seemed like every time I would stop and get in the van and go to sleep, you wake up again. The first hour was the hardest, where you've seized up a bit and you're really stiff and sore. But once you get going, then actually you feel pretty good. So your mood would kind of ebb and flow that way. You'd get into your stride again, and the mood would obviously go up again. And it would only be as that day wore on and you got more and more tired that my mood kind of went a bit went south again. But there was never I don't think there was ever a point during the week where I thought I'm not going to be able to do it. I thought, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I felt like there was no way I was going to you know, give up or stop for any reason. I might have to take more rest or whatever, but I would keep going. And that was kind of that's my memory of it, that, you know, I have had races in the past where I've wanted to quit, and I almost didn't have a reason to keep going. I was doing badly, and my legs were wrecked, and I was injured, and I just thought, I'll just, you know, cut my losses. Whereas here, there was maybe self-inflicted pressure, and I knew how to deal with the negative thoughts and stuff. You know, I've done a bit of reading on that side of things and practicing, and I think that helped as well. So even though my mood went up and down, I think I was always able to manage it, and it was managed by other people being there and helping me so much as well. You know, that gave me a lot of positive kind of thought as well. So,
because how long were you typically sleeping for, and how, like, had you set in advance the specific locations you would sleep?
Yeah, roughly speaking, I suppose I knew where we would sleep. Well, sort of. It would depend on how I was going for time. So, generally speaking, between midnight and 2 a.m. we would get to the end of a leg, and it made more sense to sleep then because it was dark, and I wanted to make most use of the light. So there was no point to, if I got to the van at 1 or 2 a.m. that was the best to have a rest while it was dark. And it was bright again by 4, because obviously at that time of year around here you do have daylight again by 4 a.m. so I would sleep at that point, and then go again when it was bright. So I think I was, you know, roughly speaking, those main stops were maybe 2 to 3 hours in length, sometimes slightly longer. They were every night, basically, between those times.
And would you be getting things like physio while you were there, or massage?
I had treatment mostly from, well, I knew them all personally, but there was on the second evening, Adam Smith, who's a local sports therapist, he drove out to Hard Knott Pass, you know, which is, it's not exactly convenient for someone to drive out to on a Saturday evening. It's a bit of an you know, an awkward place to get to, and he drove all the way out there because someone had mentioned on Facebook that my back was knackered and would anyone be around to come and help. So he came out and did a great job on my back there. And then Astrid Gibbs, who runs with our club in Ambleside, she was helping on a leg the following day. She does sports massage as well, so she was able to give me, you know, 25 minutes or whatever it was of sports massage. And and then Graham Theobald, who runs body rehab here in Staveley in the Lake District, he actually gave me two of his therapists. They were sort of on call, you know what I mean, for two of the days of the attempt. So Scout, who runs with the club as well, she came out twice on one of those days, and then Graham himself came out on the second last day on a couple of occasions as well. And he slept in his van and everything in the car park the very last night. He slept in his van so that he could be there first thing in the morning to kind of give me a quick treatment, because my knee was in bits at this stage. And he had this ice cuff thing that sort of was, you know, well, it was basically like icing my knee, but it was this nice, it pumped ice water into this kind of cuff that you put around your knee, and it felt quite nice on my knee. And he was there.
Did any things go wrong then? Like you mentioned that I think I had potentially tendonitis and quite a few blisters as well.
So the blisters were, I had some blisters. They weren't as bad as Steve's the 4 or 5 years previous. I think Steve, because the weather was so warm when Steve was doing it, his feet were sweating in his shoes. And so very early on, his feet started to suffer a bit. And, you know, I was probably lucky in that regard that it wasn't so hot, and my feet didn't get quite as battered. But by the end of it, yeah, they were pretty sore with various different bits of blisters and just chafing and rubbing. And the main problem I had was my left knee, just the inside of my left knee was what felt like, just felt like the bones had just been smashed together so much over the week that it was just constant soreness every time my foot hit the ground. So going downhill became really, really difficult on that knee. And the same side, the Achilles on the same leg, was swollen all around the ankle, basically was swollen from, yeah, just, I don't know, doing too much on the leg. And that, so the two of those things were the main injuries, I suppose. But they settled down pretty quickly afterwards. There was, the knee would give me a bit of pain on and off for the next few weeks afterwards, but the Achilles kind of settled down within a week or so. It was purely down to the load that was being put on it, I guess.
I guess that's the worry, isn't it? When you finished, is this for the rest of my life now? Or
I do think that the more of that stuff you do, the more you have to kind of think about minding yourself as well and being a bit selective about what you do. I think there's only so much you can throw at your body, especially if you're going to be a bit gung-ho and not recover properly between things, because you know, I'd like to think that I'm relatively robust in terms of not getting injured very much, but I think it's all very well thinking like that until this one thing comes along and finishes you off. You know, there's been plenty of people who have had proper cartilage damage or just constant soreness, you know, and I have had a bit of I've had lots of different niggles and stuff, and I think because I probably don't move perfectly well, you know, you're putting stress on certain tissues and at different times, and they tend to be brought to the surface by doing something as long, you know what I mean? Like if you run three times a week for half an hour, you'll probably never get injured, but if you do enough to bring something to the surface, then I think that makes you have to think about how you deal with these things, or change how you move or train. So because I wanted to get back training and racing again fairly quickly, I was fairly conservative about getting back to proper training, you know.
And what kind of nutrition did you have on the way round? Like, what did what you expected to want? Was that what you ended up wanting? And what were they?
So I was treating it fairly seriously. You know, I wanted to give it a good attempt and not fall flat on my face and make an idiot of myself. So I spoke to a performance sports nutritionist. Rebecca Dent is her name, and she came and did a talk for our club, and that was the first time I met her. So I contacted her afterwards and asked her if she would give me some advice, you know, do a one-to-one consultation, and she gave me some great advice. It was tailored to my needs, but at the same time I knew, and she knew as well, you know, that 4 or 5 days into this, you know, you might not want the things that we think you should want or will want. So there was a bit of flexibility in there. It was more about the principles of what you should, the type of things you should be eating, and the various ratios of, you know, macronutrients and all that, and the specific foods that maybe would help with inflammation or recovery after, you know, when you're getting into the van to go to sleep, and then just general nutrition in the training and the build up as well. So she was very good with that as well. So I took that side of it seriously, but yeah, it got to the point where you're really sleep deprived, you're really tired, something doesn't taste nice anymore. So you just wanted whatever it was that you were craving, that's what you wanted. And I didn't care what, you know, the science behind it or anything like that. So I ended up mostly consuming in the last few days. I remember just wanting chips all the time, and greasy food, you know, not all the time, not when I was actually moving. Obviously I wasn't eating a whole pile when I was moving. I was eating little bits of sandwiches and Snickers bars and high calorie things like that. But when I got into stops, it was, yeah, chips and beans on toast with cheese, or some sort of a nice savory sandwich, some pasta at times. The hill food then was obviously easier to carry and eat. So, you know, chocolate bars of various types. Like, I have a proper sweet tooth, and when you get sleep deprived and tired, obviously you crave a bit of sugar, and I was eating Bounty bars and Twixes and Snickers and Mars bars and Turkish Delights and Jelly Babies and that kind of stuff, and drinking I really like fizzy water as well, because it's just, you know, it's kind of refreshing. So I was drinking fizzy water all the time. Someone was carrying fizzy water. I was a bit of a diva, I suppose. I had Lucozade, Coke, fizzy water. They were the three kind of drinks, I suppose, I was subsisting on. And lots of sweet stuff while I was actually on the hill. And then takeaways, like chips from the takeaway and things like that, really. But I was picky. You know.
I've always wondered, how often do you clean your teeth? Like, because that's the one thing that, if I haven't slept, I just hate that feeling. Like, would you stop and do your teeth every time you had that stop every time you slept? Or
I honestly can't remember, but it must have been. I mean, I wasn't doing it when I was out on the hill anyway. So I think I'll have done it when I was in the van. I'm sure I forgot to do it at times, and not because I'm a horrible bastard, but because I was half asleep and didn't even know where I was half the time. So I get that feeling as well. I know what you mean about, yeah, not, you know, when you haven't washed your teeth, you know what I mean? It's like a bit of a horrible feeling, but
it's not your job. It's one of your entourage is responsible for that. Yeah. It's like
they were carrying a little mobile, wash bag.
Floss for you. Yeah. And then, I mean, you break the record by, was it 6 hours in the end, which is 7 hours even, which is it's a good amount. And then since you've actually helped out Sabrina in her attempts, like, What's that been like to, because you obviously, you had a huge amount of advice from Steve. Like, has it been nice to be able to almost take on that elderly statesman type role in giving the advice? Or has there a bit of you been like, actually, you know, I'd quite like for my record to last a bit longer?
Yeah, so I would like it to last a bit longer, but I knew when Sabrina told me she was going to do it that there was a very good chance it wouldn't last any longer, because of what she's done. You know, I mean, she seems like she's unbreakable. You know what I mean? She can just do long race after long race. So I knew mentally it wasn't going to be a problem for her. She's as mentally strong a person as I've ever come across. So yeah, I knew it was a serious attempt and she was going to give it a really good go, but equally I didn't want to be not involved because I knew how important it was for me to have Steve's help. Like, I knew how helpful it was for me to have Steve's attempt, and I always said it, like, from the time that I had it done or even leading up to it, I thought what Steve did was amazing, and if someone else was going to want my help, then I was going to be as good as I could about it as well, and give as much of my help as I could. So, you know, I did the leg. I did a leg on the Wednesday. So Sabrina started on the Monday, and I did a leg for her on the Wednesday night, and then another one early on the Friday morning. And I was meant to be on a leg on the Saturday as well, but a friend of mine in the club had, because Sabrina had to move her attempt. She delayed it a few days because the weather was really bad over the weekend she was meant to start. So she delayed it a few days, but that meant her attempt was going into the following weekend, where I had already committed to helping a friend of mine on his Bob Graham. So I couldn't do that Saturday leg with her, but yeah, I did the other two, and I wanted to be part of it because, well, firstly, she lives here in the Lakes as well, and she came and I gave her, you know, I don't think she needed much advice from me because she's so experienced anyway, but she did, we did meet up early in the year before her attempt, and chatted about it, and you know, any advice I felt I could give, I was very keen to give it, because if she was going to break it, then I wanted to be able to say I did my best for her, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if she didn't break it, then great, I hold on to the record. But if she did break it, at least I could sleep easy knowing that I had given everything I could to it as well. So,
Is there ever a danger that you give advice and actually it's the wrong advice? is that a worry that your best of intentions might actually suddenly turn into looking very different?
Yeah, I mean, I probably have given shit advice to loads of people. I say, Sabrina's that experienced at this type of thing. You know, she's done multi-day adventure races. She's won the summer spine. She's won the spine, the winter spine.
She's done world adventure races that are as long in terms of days, yeah.
Absolutely, like, totally sleep deprived, the dragon's back, you know, there's loads of stuff she's done that I can't even think of, you know what I mean? So it's not like she needed a whole pile of my advice, but I suppose she wanted to know, you know, I can't even remember now, but maybe about the route and stuff, because she did change a few bits of the route, and
Would you think she found a better way or just an alternative way?
More like, it was still generally the same, but there was a few legs where she put one fell in a different leg that kind of saved time on one leg and added an extra fell on another leg. And the jury's out, I suppose. It's hard to know whether it was quicker or not. It certainly, like, one of the particular changes she made, I went and recce'd for her because I was doing that leg with her. So I went out beforehand and recce'd it, and I kind of thought to myself, geez, yeah, that might be a good idea. It was a bit more direct, but it meant a very, very steep descent and then a very, very steep ascent back up the other side. So whereas me and Steve, or Steve's route contoured kind of around and up, so you didn't drop as much weight, but you had longer to travel. And it was kind of those types of changes where it might save you a bit of climbing here, but it would add on a bit of distance there. And
yeah, it probably depends on the athlete as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, so Sabrina on that particular change, Sabrina wanted to avoid a bit of, there's a descent off Caudill Moor, and it's a bit crap and bitty, and you know, you're picking your way down it, and she was keen to maybe avoid that, do less distance, but kind of take the hit of the extra climb, you know, or the steeper climb. So but in the end, actually, she got to the leg start with me, and she decided that she would actually do the traditional way, the way Steve had done it. So it didn't matter in the end. But there was other small changes as well that she made, and are quite interesting. Like, I think if I was doing it again, I'd certainly consider doing them. Like, she thought a lot about it, and she put a lot of preparation into it, to be fair. So
and was it quite strange seeing her during the latter stages? Like, was did it give you flashbacks of your attempts, and do you think, like, did it give you an insight into what you would have looked like from the outside as well?
It gave me a reminder, I suppose, yeah, of how difficult it is, you know. The thing is, we were never moving really, really fast, because that's not the nature of it, you know. You have to conserve yourself. So when you're pacing a leg, doesn't feel difficult because you're fresh, you know. Like, I was fresh as a daisy, and Sabrina had been going for 3-4 days, so you know, it doesn't feel difficult then. So you can almost trick yourself into thinking, oh, this isn't so bad. But the person doing the attempt is absolutely annihilated and sleep deprived and sore and hungry and grumpy and everything else. So it reminded me of that, I suppose, that you know, it almost tricked you into thinking this wasn't so bad, but when you look and see the, you're sort of, you know, I did a night section, and I we finished at about 10 a.m. or whatever. I'd started the previous night at maybe 10 or 11 p.m. and we finished my section the following morning about 10 a.m. and you know, you've missed a night's sleep and you're absolutely knackered for the rest of the day, and that's when it kind of hits you that actually, yeah, it's, you add day after day after day of no sleep, and it's you just go into a downward spiral, really. You know, your body just absolutely gets annihilated, because sleep obviously is the most important element of recovery, I guess. So that's the one thing you're missing.
And you know, so Sabrina was going for the overall record, and we've had conversations on the podcast a few times actually just about how if you get to certain distances, it does appear that the field flattens out between men and women. Like, do you get the sense that this is the Wainwrights is a type of challenge where there could be that the best record for all time could be a female one, or do you think it's that just the standard of the females is so incredibly high that are taking on these longer challenges that actually they're almost that eventually there will be a male that will beat whatever record they set?
Yeah, like it's a tricky one, because I do think that, like, a pure raw speed, like the 100 meters, we know that it's generally accepted that, you know, it's unlikely that a female is going to break the overall 100 meters world record. But as you go up the the same goes all the way up to marathon, I guess, if you look at the elite lady men's and women's times. And then as you progress up through the distances in the ultra world, it's certainly... it's getting closer and closer as you move up the distances, and the 100 mile distance is, you know, an example of that, where someone like Courtney DeWalter can turn up to UTMB and be in the was she in the top 10 this year or
close nice to
last year, or Rory Bosio back in 2014, I think she was like sixth overall or something like that. And you know, so you can see at the elite end of that sport that it's getting closer as the distances extend. And then when you go, you know, stupidly long again, like something like the spine or the Wainwrights or whatever, it's probably flattened out a little bit more again, because it's not, and it's no disrespect to anyone, it's not about, you know, your VO2 max or your overall fitness. It's there's so many other things that come into it. So there's your mind anyway, for a start, which is probably, you know, arguably the most important thing in something very, very long like that. And then there's the logistics and managing yourself well and making sure you deal with problems when they come up. And like someone like Sabrina is very, very, from watching her, you know, I learned a lot from watching Sabrina, how regimented she is about dealing with or having, you know, how much she's thought about different things that could happen or did happen. And you know, she's prepared. So where someone with less experience, a male with less experience who might be quicker than Sabrina, loses 10 minutes because he's not as efficient as her, you know, that's where someone like Sabrina excels. And and obviously mentally as well, then there's, I don't know of anyone really, you know, I don't know how you measure it, but there can't be too many people who are mentally stronger than her. So that's, you know, there's certainly no difference there in terms of the mental side of things. So if you agree that your mental strength is one of the most important factors that goes into it, well, then there's not going to be any difference between male and female, or some would argue that females are better predisposed at being mentally strong. So that's I guess why it flattens out. But I would just say that, like, if all the best, the top male ultra runners and the top female ultra runners turned up at a 300 mile race, it's still likely that the top male ultra runner would win that race, in my opinion. You know, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. Like Jasmine Paris is probably the strongest, certainly in this country, the strongest female, arguably the strongest female over very, very long distances, because she has the mental strength, but she would be quicker as well than anyone else over that distance, I guess. So when she turns up to the spine, there's a really good, like, as we saw, there's a really good chance that she'll win it. But who's to say that if John Kelly had been there when she was doing it, that we don't know, do we, that whether she'd be quicker or he'd be quicker or what, you know, or someone who's better than John, you know what I mean? So it's a very difficult one to know, you know, the right answer to that. But it's true that I think as the distances get longer, females tend to be, you know, gradually getting more and more competitive. So,
and if you were to take, say, someone like Killian or someone who, you know, was really top end at the longer distances, what kind of time do you think the perfect run could get at the Wainwrights, or do you think there just can't be a perfect run at the Wainwrights because of the nature of how long it is and how, you know, beastly it is?
Yeah, like I think if someone like Killian Jornet wants to do it, or someone of his standard, if there's anyone else of his standard, then, you know, you can start to think about chopping days rather than hours off it, obviously. But I suppose, yeah, there is, it's like you say, a lot of things have to happen to get that perfect round. Like when Killian Jornet did his BG up here, it was arguably brilliant conditions underfoot. Not that he would have needed it, you know, he was still going to be he was, to my mind, he would still have beaten the record. But certainly, like, stuff like that are going in your favor is an advantage. So, you know, if the ground conditions were perfect and the weather was benign and just, you know, calm and not too hot and whatever else for a full week, then someone like him, I suppose, you're looking at like sub 5 days, I guess. I don't know, you know. Like,
and do you think it's right that we should have almost FKT tourists, people who come in who aren't necessarily who, you know, don't know the history, don't know the trail, don't know the people, and, you know, essentially to do a Killian, to just turn up in perfect conditions with the best, like, best ever assembled pacing crew, don't even look at a map, and basically get led round an FKT. Like, do you think
you didn't load that one much?
I didn't, because it's not my community, but I'm not the happiest about it myself, and I'm not even from the Lake District, so I don't know how I'd feel if I actually had more ownership of things like the Bob Graham record. But is it taken with good spirit by the community, or is there a tension?
Yeah, like, I can't speak for everyone up here, but I was quite impressed with how Killian did it. You know, he was very respectful of the tradition. He, you know, rang people up personally to ask him if they would help. He followed the rules as they are. You know, he treated everyone to a few drinks and dinner afterwards, and he was pretty understated about the whole thing. Really, I know it's hard to be understated if you're him and you've got the kind of profile he has, but he was very respectful about it, and I certainly thought it was I didn't have a problem with it, but it wasn't my record, I guess. But, and I don't think Billy Bland had a problem with it either, by the looks of things. And in general, like, if you look at the people who did pace him, they're all very well known people within the community, and they obviously didn't have a problem with it either. And I think I was just, when he said he was going to do it, given, you know, what he's done in his time, I was pretty sure he would, you know, break the record by a chunk, and that's not taking away anything from Billy Bland. It's just the sheer impressiveness of the stuff he's done, you know, the level he's at. And I was just inspired by it, you know, that it could be done that quick. So I didn't have any kind of negative feelings in that regard. But I do understand that. It's nice that if a local person has it and he's trained on the fells, and he's maybe not seen as a professional athlete, but you know, Killian Jornet is only a professional athlete because of how good he is. Like, he's created that from his hard work down through the years, and that's quite an impressive thing. So was your question, was there another part to the question about
no that was, I mean, I think you've covered that quite well, actually. Now we've got a few questions from the do-batters. Most of them we've incorporated already, but one of the questions is, have you got a favorite hill to train on and a favorite hill to run in the lakes?
It kind of changes a bit, I suppose, probably based on my mood at times or what I've been doing in the recent past. So at the moment, it's really, really busy in the lakes, which is great for the economy up here. But if you're wanting a nice, quiet run, then you need to pick and choose, or you need to go at certain times of the day. So I like over around Kentmere direction, High Street and Ilbel and areas like that, because they're a bit quieter in the height of summer. So at the moment, you know, I'd be kind of over that direction and doing some running there. And you don't meet too many people. You do meet people, but it's quite nice to be sort of, yeah, on your own when you're in the Fells. But, you know, I also like Langdale a lot, and the Fells around Langdale and the Langdale Horseshoe route itself has got some great hills on it. So Biscoe is one of my favourite hills because it's just the nice views off it. And it's not the most impressive or biggest or anything like that. It's just, it's a really nice hill and there's a nice race on it. And yeah, I'd find it really difficult to pick an overall favourite, really.
And then another question we've got from Kev is, have you got your eyes on races like the Barclay?
Well, it's not that I wouldn't like to someday give it a try, but it's not the race that kind of that I think, oh yeah, I'd really love to do that. I think presumably the what attracts people to that is the fact that it's so difficult and so few people have done it that you want to pit yourself against that kind of a challenge, and there is a kind of an attraction in that regard. But it's almost like it's so, I mean, you have to go to the States for a start, and you've got to be invited, as far as I know, or write a, you know, a groveling letter to try and get in, I think, something like that. So it's probably not been on my radar because there's so many nice races to do a bit closer to home, and like stuff in the Alps, like, you know, Ultra Trail Monte Rosa or Tour de Gens or various races like that, that kind of excite me a bit more, I suppose. Less suffering, less misery is probably the right word.
And have you got any kind of big challenges in your future? Do you feel, have you got another one that you'd like to do? Or
Danny Campbell is, as we speak, is doing all the Munros in Scotland, and I would love to give that a go at some point. I had been talking about it with Neil McKenzie, who helped me so much last year, and you know, he's egging me on again, like keen for me to give it a go. And I'd probably like to do that at some point. In terms of challenges anyway. And then there's loads of races that I would love to do, and I think my horizons have broadened a bit. Even more recently, I went out with did a little bit of a section with Dan Lawson on his Le Jog record, and although I'm not keen on road running, and I'm not saying I'm going to do that particular thing, but doing something, you know, maybe more like a 24-hour track race or something like that, that's much more about running and less about stomping uphill. I'd like to give that a try at some point, I think. And there's a good history of, there's a good standard of 24-hour racing in Ireland. We've tended to have some really good runners. Ian Keith, who's won the Spine, he's really good at that kind of thing. And, the names have gone out of my head now. Yeah, I've just drawn a blank, but a great history of it. Tony Mangan has done amazing times at 24, 48, 72 hours, various different things. I'd like to think I could try something like that. I probably wouldn't do very well, but it'd be nice to give it a go.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and, you know, congratulations again on what is just an epic challenge. And if you're ever in London and you need a running buddy, give us a shout. And thank you from all of the listeners.
No worries, nice to speak to you guys.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Thanks, Paul. Speak to you soon.
All right, thank you.
Bye
now.
Could you ever take on something like that yourself, do you think?
Oh, I'd love to do the Wainwrights. The thing is, I did walking before I did running, and doing that, you have an appreciation of how difficult that something like that is, because you know how long it takes you to walk up one fell, or to do a round, or a horseshoe, or whatever, and so you have a real appreciation for it. And so when you think about, right, so covering all the Wainwrights in one go, it's fucking insane. It is fucking insane when you put it together. And just in terms of working out the route and everything that goes with it, it is such a mammoth undertaking.
Because they should almost make a rule that you can't follow the same route. Like, everyone has to...
Every route has to be different.
Every route has to be different by 30%. Because that would be good, right? If you're suddenly... Because in reality, whoever did this first, you know, if Steve was the first person, and I don't know the history before Steve, if he was the first person to properly sit down and actually analyze it, then that is a huge undertaking compared to the next person who's just looking at trimming.
Well, this is my plan. My plan is to wait for global warming. sail between wait till it's flooded and then sail between the seats and everything on a speedboat and like beat that.
Yeah, nice. As long as Strava still exists, it'll still work.
That's the things that we're gonna hope for when the planet is flooded. At least I've got a crack at the Wainwrights. No, but what I like about I don't know, it's funny how these rounds happen and stuff like that, but the way the thing about the Wainwrights is that it's just kind of fucking insane. It hasn't been known as a thing, not in the same way the Bob Graham round. The Bob Graham round is, you know, famous. The Wainwrights,
because it's too hard to take on for it to gather momentum.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The Wainwrights is known as the Wainwrights because it is a hiking challenge, a challenge for walkers to be done over a lifetime. That is what it is commonly known as. You know, getting all the Wainwrights by the time that you die is a massive achievement.
I love the idea.
In a week.
I love the idea of he's finishing and there's someone who's just ahead of him that he runs past and they're like, and that guy's like, I've just finished the Wainwrights. It's taken me 60 years to finish the Wainwrights. And, oh, who are you? I've done the Wainwrights. How long did it take you? 6 days. I've wasted my life.
What other place do you go, okay, I'm going to run all the hills in this entire range?
Yeah. There can't be that many where it's like there isn't so many without there being more.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that what I'd struggle with is just from years of some of summer holidays spent in tents in fields where it's wet and miserable. I don't know if I'd be able to keep it together if it was just soggy for hour after hour.
That's the Lake District. That's the thing. I think, because we always talk about this all the time, we think it'd be wonderful to move to the Lake District. And we're like, that's because every time we go, it's sunny. Like, if you're going to have, like, realistic Lake District where it's always wet and it's always
rain. There are lakes there for a reason.
And it's... It's the only place where you can go up a mountain and still fall halfway into a bog. You're like, how?
How is that possible?
How
is there a lake at the top of this?
I know. You're like, how can you make this any more wet than by immersing me in wetness? And so that's the thing. And I think, you know, people move there. I think it's really interesting when people move to the Lake District because I think, okay, it shows a sign of intent and people absolutely love the Lake District and stuff like that, and rightly so, it is stunning. But you are very limited in the places you can work. I mean, like, it's literally coffee shops and or clothing outlets in the various places. It doesn't have a burgeoning industry.
Yeah.
Nor should it, because it, of course, it's protected. So there's only a very limited number of things you can do.
Yeah, you've really got to be committed to fell running to the extent that you're essentially going to sacrifice any career, because you wouldn't have a career that you could necessarily try unless you're like a graphics designer or something that can just work.
Yeah, I was thinking that you want to, if you had a business, I mean, what the best business to have in the Lake District would be an Amazon warehouse, because you'd be able to hire all of these runners. would be at huge distances in incredibly quick times.
And you also, you get them to pay you because you tell them it's a training plan.
It's the Amazon training facility. It's the Amazon training facility. And you literally could put things on different levels and everything. And you wouldn't need a separate personal thing. You build levels into it. It'd be a giant, like, hamster, like, play. Yeah, it's incredible. That's my... You think, what business would you be able to, like, where you could make do of all of these, like, errant fell runners and wannabe athletes in a, because that's the thing, it's just, you know, I can understand why people move there. It is stunning, but bloody hell, it's where.
Yeah, 100%. And I wonder if, you know, will, as we run out of FKTs, like, as the significant ones,
as we run out of guests,
but the Wade Wrights, is it's reasonably well known now. You know, will the Munros become more known? Like, will people start challenging that more? Are we going to suddenly see new routes created and longer FKTs kind of named just to create more variety? Because at the moment, people can go out and break FKTs because no one's really been challenging that much other than the Bob Graham. Whereas 20 years, the times will be very good and you're going to have only the top people that are going to go for them.
The thing is, why are the Wainwrights called the Wainwrights? Because some old bloke decided to walk them and then draw a few picture books. I mean, they're brilliant and everything, but that's it. Why? I think you need to plan ahead here. What would the Hellards look like? You need to find some easily summitable peaks.
It's a string of Australian women across South London. That's what the Hellards looks like. It was invented in the noughties.
And many, I wish I hadn't asked that.
Many people have followed, believe me. Some have been before as well. summited all of them.
Summited. Were they conquered or were they not? Oh, goodness. That is...
But, well, to end on that note, to end on that lovely note, if you've liked this episode, we spoke to Jasmine Paris about her attempt, and... we spoke about the spine and then how she trained. That was amazing. We spoke to Damo Hall, who has, we spoke to John Kelly as well. Both of them recently have set the FKTs for the Pennine Way, and they talk about their training. John was talking about Barclay Marathons. Damo was talking about how actually he was a hiker before. Nick Spinks, who's done the doubles, the triple doubles. We chatted to her. She's uber cool. And if you really want to get a sense of the culture, one of the early episodes from the lovely photographer,
the famous
James
photographer.
Appleton. Yeah. He goes into a lot of depth, actually, just explaining almost the history of the area. It was really interesting about how the races worked, the teams.
That was incredibly insightful as a snapshot of what it's like being a fell runner or a runner in the Lake District, in incredible detail as well.
Yeah. Really, really interesting.
And I suppose he sees it in that way, doesn't he? Because he's a photographer, so he sees it in a
good
way.
Point.
And he's done a bit of running.
And he's done a bit of running, Joe. Absolutely, absolutely. So those are some episodes we'd recommend. If you want to ask questions to future guests, then follow us on Instagram. We read through, incorporate them into the questions, but then at the end go through any ones that we think are still good. If you'd like to recommend anyone as a guest, then email david@badboyrunning.com. Please do subscribe and review us on iTunes, because that's how we get our credibility with future guests. And if you've got any funny stories or any feedback, then letters@badboyrunning.com. We're reading them now. We're reading them. We're engaging as a podcast. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And if you want to see the other stories people have been sharing, then we do have a Facebook group that's it's quite fun, and lots of silly banter in there. So thanks for listening, guys. And we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Bye.
I must admit I was a clown to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back. Yes, and give me one more try. Cause a love like this should have
Fuck you, buddy.